Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. All of us have had our feelings hurt, and then some people, when they do so, they insist that it was just a joke. Well, therein lies the issue. The notion of what connotes an actual joke presupposes certain criteria. Dr. Gregory Popchak tells us that there is a law of charity involved in the work of jokes, of good-natured ribbing, so to speak. But it is easy to take it too far, even when charity is involved. And it gets worse when there's no charity involved. One can't presuppose the goodwill of the joker. And that's the issue that has arisen pertaining to this whole situation with Jimmy Kimmel. And I know there's a whole conversation to be had, and you know, many people are insisting things like First Amendment rights infringement or FCC overreach. You can have a conversation about the latter. The fact of the matter is the populace, the general judiciary of the populace, are speaking in a certain way, and that's something we have to listen to. That for humor to truly be humor, it must presuppose and operate within the bounds of good-natured charity. We go on from there to speak with Reggie Littlejohn. New regulations from the State Administration for Religious Affairs in China have enacted a ban on several major forms of online evangelization for religious clergy of all religions, including, and therefore I argue, especially Catholic priests. Now, this is not a surprise. We've known for a while now that the CCP is going to continue systematically encroaching upon the bounds of evangelization. Free speech is not an enshrined right in the civil reality of CCP and therefore China. And so Catholic priests, and in fact Catholics in general, will continue to suffer from it. And so it is incumbent upon biblical Christians, you and I, to keep trying to find ways that the gospel may be brought to those people, including in mainland China, who need to hear the word of God. And then finally, we're joined by my friend Dr. Nathan Schlieter to bring about a kind of rethinking of the philosophy of male and female, sex and marriage, and a proper understanding of the human person and all these capacities that bring about romantic love. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, September 23rd. It's the Feast of Padre Pio. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. The man accused of trying to assassinate President Trump in Florida has been found guilty. NBC News' George Solis with details after a jury found Ryan Ruth attempted to kill Trump while he was playing golf at his Palm Beach golf course when running for re-election last year.
Ryan Ruth was found guilty on all five counts by this jury. It happened after about almost 2.5 hours of deliberation.
Ruth reportedly appeared to try to stab himself in the neck after the verdict was read in the courtroom. In a post on Truth Social, Trump said Ruth is an evil man that had the evil intention, and he thanked the Justice Department for its work. Ruth is set to be sentenced December 18th. President Trump says NATO nations should shoot down Russian aircraft that enters their airspace. He made the comment as he met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the United Nations. It marked the fourth time the leaders have met since Trump returned to office as they look for an end to Ukraine's war with Russia. Jimmy Kimmel's late-night talk show is set for its return tonight. He was suspended indefinitely last week by ABC following comments he made related to Charlie Kirk's assassination. Kimmel's been off the air since Wednesday. However, some local stations won't air Jimmy Kimmel live, as the Sinclair Broadcast Group as well as Nexstar Media Group are both planning to preempt the show anyway, as both remain in talks with ABC. And electronic baseballs and strike zone calls are making their way to the big leagues. Major League Baseball announcing that the automatic balls and strike systems will be implemented for the 2026 season. Each team will be given two challenges each game, but will keep them if they're successful. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. It's no surprise to anyone that the West is still reeling from the massacre of conservative individuals, particularly most recently Charlie Kirk. And the most recent development that is causing people to get up in arms is the suspension of Jimmy Kimmel over comments that he made on his comedy show. Joining me to have a conversation about viewing this from a sound Catholic perspective is Dr. Gregory Popchak. He and his bride co-host More to Life, produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN. They also put out the Catholic HOM app, Households on Mission. Download it and watch as your family thrives in the vision of the church. Greg, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Marcus. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, always a joy to have you on. And I want to say thank you for your time and generosity, and also for your willingness to help us view at least this event from a sound Catholic perspective, because we don't want to politicize it. We don't want to turn this into a legal debate, even though there is that. What's the Catholic approach here?
Sure, sure. Well, and other guests, I'm sure, could speak to those dimensions of the issue. But I wanted to take a look at it from a sociological and psychological point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's actually a whole lot of research into what makes comedy funny.
Right.
In fact, at the University of Colorado Boulder, they have something called the Humor Research Lab, directed by Dr. Peter McGraw, which, when you think about it, doesn't sound all that funny at all. But it takes a serious look at humor, and studying things like how does humor impact well-being, what actually is funny and why it's funny, and what, for example, the difference is between humor and verbal abuse. So to kind of talk about the whole comedian situation, I want to start with, say, an interpersonal relationship. Let's talk about a relationship between a husband and a wife. And let's say the husband makes a joke at his wife's expense. And she doesn't react well to that.
Right.
Now, what's going to predict... And then he says, well, I was just joking. Well, how do we know what's really going on there? So Dr. Peter McGraw at the Humor Research Lab says that in order for something to be funny, especially a joke at somebody else's expense,
right,
it has to be an example of what he calls a benign violation. So let me give you an example of that. So my birthday was last week, and a friend of mine commented on my Instagram post about it. Boy, Greg, you are really old now. And I wrote back, takes one to know one, geezer. Now, you wouldn't normally walk up to somebody and just say, gosh, you're so old, you're a geezer, right? That wouldn't be received well. But my friend and I, because we know we like each other,
right,
because we know we respect each other,
right,
because we know we care for each other and have empathy for each other, we're able to say those violations, we were able to violate each other's boundaries of what was normal and appropriate, and laugh about it, because it was funny and we knew it came from a loving place. Well, let's go back to that husband. You know, if they have a good relationship and his wife feels connected to him, and she knows that he's looking out for her well-being 9 times out of 10, she can take that ribbing and laugh. But if the relationship is somehow insecure, or he's not been kind to her, or not demonstrated appropriate levels of respect or empathy, now it's going to feel like verbal abuse. And if she objects to the joke, and he says, well, I was just kidding... He wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
He was engaging in a passive-aggressive act. It was a violation that wasn't benign.
Right.
And that means it wasn't funny. Well, the same thing is true about comedians. In order for a joke to land, especially if you're going to tell a joke about a group of people or a particular individual, you have to be able to communicate, in addition to kind of ribbing them, that you at least have some basic respect for their humanity, basic positive regard for the person or empathy for the position that they're in, some sense that I can relate to this, don't we all kind of relate to this? There's the communication of this kind of basic respect for the person, which makes the joke land and makes it funny. But if you fail to communicate that basic respect or empathy or regard for that person's humanity or that group's humanity, you're not telling a joke, you're engaging in verbal abuse, because the violation that is communicated by a joke at somebody else's expense isn't benign anymore. You're scolding them. You're lecturing them. You're talking about what idiots they are and how stupid they are. And basically what you're doing is you're getting the group of people around you that think like you and teaching them to verbally assault these other people who don't think like you. And you can always also chuckle at how dumb those people are or how fat or how stupid or how whatever they are. Mm-hmm. But that's not humor. That's aggression. That's bullying. And so, laying aside again the legal and the political ramifications of all this, when we engage in that kind of behavior and get pushback from it, that's a logical response to my bullying. I don't get to hide out behind just saying, well, that was a joke. Yeah, it was bullying dressed up as a joke.
Right.
It wasn't actually humor.
And so when we view, for example, the suspension of Jimmy Kimmel, we can really just responsibly say this is the consequence of a violation. There's a whole free speech argument that people are trying to leverage, but the truth of the matter is the collective conscience of a large swath of the populace was offended. And it was offended because their humanity was an affront to their humanity. And so this is a rightful conversation to have.
Well, exactly. I mean, and does he have the right to say those kinds of? Well, sure. We in a free society, we have the right to say those things. But the people who are the target of those jokes, quote unquote, the target of that verbal abuse, have the right to push back. That's how the market works in capitalism.
Right.
If enough people say, I don't like this, and they stop watching it, or if sponsors pull out of it, that's just how capitalism works. And you don't get to complain about being treated that way if you actively and intentionally alienate your market by forgetting the basic rules of comedy and instead start engaging in regular habits of verbal abuse.
And so, considering things as they are now with regard to the whole Kimmel suspension, there's been a weaponization of the narrative on the part of another swath of the population to argue that we're witnessing a tyranny of a totalitarian regime. The truth of the matter is far less nefarious than that. It's simply that the American populace has spoken, that this is a line that we've crossed.
Well, yes. Now, I mean, and again, I don't want to get too deep into this, but I mean, I've even heard from some conservative sources, I mean, Ted Cruz, for example, mm-hmm. the National Review, that the FCC may have overplayed its mm-hmm. hand in this case with Jimmy Kimmel specifically. And I don't feel qualified to speak to that. But I think there's a legitimate conversation to have about that part of it. But that said, even if that aside, when somebody engages in behavior that alienates a particular group of people and that group of people push back, that is a logical and reasonable response to it. You don't get to just say, I was just joking, why don't you guys have a sense of humor about yourself? Because if I'm not able to convey that I respect your basic humanity, that I have empathy for you, that I can appreciate where you're coming from even if I don't agree with you or think that you're being a little silly, then the joke that I'm telling isn't really a joke. It's me being a bully but wearing a jester's mask.
Right. And so
it's kind of terrifying when you think about it.
I was going to bring that up because that raises the question of the jester's privilege. The jester was always granted a privilege to even jibe the king, but it was always understood that there's a threshold of what's called good fun. We can also admit that popular comedy today has veered into political activism rather than good, sound-natured fun.
Well, right, and again, it kind of goes back to let's go to the playground, right? Mm. You know, if one group of kids on the playground hates this other kid or other group of kids, they will say things about that other group that they personally find funny, but are humiliating and degrading to the other person or other group.
Right.
That's not funny. That's bullying.
Right.
That's aggression. That's violence. And we have a right as a society to set boundaries around that kind of behavior.
And again, you know, that goes back to the corrective that comes from virtue ingrained in society.
That's exactly right. And there's this, I think, even though we don't all have the language to kind of speak about benign violations mm-hmm. and why this particular kind of joke didn't land or did land, we all know on a human level where we're being treated in a manner that is beneath our dignity as sons and daughters of God.
Greg, thank you very much for grounding us, for being a kind of lightning rod amidst all of this, and help us consider this conversation from a Catholic perspective.
Always a pleasure, Marcus. Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Gregory Popchak. He and his bride Lisa put out the Catholic HOM app. I greatly encourage we download it. Let's think of the world, our life, and all our operations from a Catholic perspective. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
On the next Epiphany.
Hi, Vanessa Denha-Garmo here. It's time for Parish of the Week Wednesday. We'll hear all about the National Shrine of the Little Flower Basilica in Royal Oak from their pastor, Father John Benton. Catholic author Joseph McGivney will be speaking at the annual Detroit Bishop's Dinner next month to benefit Guest House. He'll share all the details.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. New regulations from the State Administration for Religious Affairs in China have enacted a ban on several major forms of online evangelization for religious clergy of all religions, including, and I argue, targeting especially Catholic priests. Reggie Littlejohn joins us with more. Reggie is no stranger to this program, founder and president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers, an international coalition to expose and oppose forced abortion, gendercide, and sexual slavery in China. You can visit her work at womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org. Reggie, great to speak with you again. How are you?
I'm very well. Great to speak with you too, Mark.
So, I get no surprise, right? It's not like we're caught off guard that the CCP is doing this. Was there a build up to this? Were there a few things that led to the CCP making this crackdown?
Well, I think that came in the aftermath of Pope Leo accessing the role of the throne of Peter, the chair of Peter. So between Francis and Leo, Pope Leo, the CCP just appointed two bishops without any kind of approval of the Vatican.
Right.
So I mean, they're basically flaunting this China Vatican deal. And they're cracking down on Catholic clergy. I think that Catholicism, as he says, a particular target of the CCP because of the existence of the Pope, of a human leader who demands or who needs the loyalty of people from China. Other religions don't have that. So they do particularly target the Catholic faith, and are really trying to clamp down on it.
I've always gotten the impression that the CCP looks upon Rome and looks upon the magisterial hierarchy of the church with a tremendous amount of trepidation because here is an authority that they simply cannot clamp down on.
Right, because it's in Rome. So they can clamp down. They also are doing terrible things to the Muslim Uyghurs and also the Falun Gong. But these are people who are within the borders of China. And the Pope is not inside of the borders of China, so they're doing everything they can to clamp down on it. So this new code of conduct for religious clergy, the full text of it is not publicly available, but according to reports, it bans preaching or evangelizing online without explicit government permission. It obliges clergy to register with the state mm-hmm. and participate in regular state government-led training and ideological education. It bans them from evangelizing to minors and increases the surveillance and reporting requirements for all church activities. So this is a process of trying to stop the spread of Catholicism right. in China because they are so threatened by it.
Could you also comment on the fact that this order also effectively stifles fundraising, which is honestly a very typical religious activity, especially within Christianity, and education and the fostering of educational opportunities?
Well, that's right. So how many organizations rely on online fundraising to support their programs or even for a building fund or whatever? So that's another thing that they have clamped down on. And another thing also is online education. You know, how young people in particular can really respond to videos online or whatever online education courses, and they have clamped down on those as well. So this is part of their campaign of sinicization. It's a hard word, but what it means is basically subordinating all religions, including the Catholic faith, to the Chinese communist ideology, that churches need to be a mouthpiece for communist ideology. And according to China Aid, which monitors such things, people in churches have to sing hymns of praise to the Chinese Communist right. Party before they can sing hymns of praise to Jesus.
That's right, that's right. To the CCP and to Xi Jinping, or at least elevate Xi Jinping. You know, it's funny, for as atheistic as they claim to be, they certainly do deify Xi Jinping.
Well, that's the thing, is that the Chinese Communist Party wants to replace God, and they've actually removed the Ten Commandments from mm-hmm. the walls of churches and replaced them with the Ten Commandments or ten sayings from either Mao Zedong or right. Xi Jinping. And everybody is encouraged, and some people are even required, to engage in Xi Jinping thought every night, which is a brainwashing program where you have to listen to what he says and then answer questions. And if you don't, you come to work the next day, your boss can say to you, you know what, Marcus, I noticed that you didn't do your Xi Jinping thought last night, and you can get deemed for it in your job.
We take First Amendment rights completely for granted here in the West, especially here in the United States of America. And if you could also just share with us, what happens if a clergyman of the Catholic Church, so a priest, were to violate or offend this law and therefore evangelize online without the prior approval of the state?
Well, what they say is basically that he will need to make amends immediately, and if he doesn't, that he will be prosecuted under the law. But they don't necessarily escalate things slowly like that. They mm-hmm. don't necessarily give people a second chance. I mean, they have been tearing down churches and tearing down crosses and detaining clergy and even detaining church members. So they are a law unto themselves. They don't follow their own laws.
They also talk about revoking religious status, and I really shouldn't laugh. This is terrible. This is true. This is a true affront to the God-given right of profession of faith. But how on earth do you revoke the religious status of an individual? It's a faith you profess.
Well, okay, so we're talking about the difference between faith. I mean, you can't, mm-hmm. Revoke somebody's faith. Or revoking their religious status which means that they will not have permission from the government
right.
to do anything. Okay, so they won't be able to hold services. They won't be able to officially meet. I mean, they can shut down their church. They can do whatever they want.
Right.
And
this speaks to, therefore, the massive liturgical overstep of the CCP. The insistence up till this point is that China wants authority, liturgical and sacramental authority over priests and over bishops, including the revoking of their public faculties as and when they deem fit.
Exactly. So that's one of the threats if they go against these new regulations. But they've been doing that anyway, even for people who haven't gone against the regulations.
Yep.
You know, I think that basically if you are an effective pastor, if people are flocking to your church, if you are speaking the truth, if you are drawing people to God, you are a big target to the Chinese Communist Party.
Reggie, you do so much to meet the needs of especially women in China, not just in terms of their natural rights, but also in terms of their religious and faith desires and rights. Our listeners right now, undoubtedly, they're listening to this and they want to do something. What can they do?
Well, go on to Women's Rights Without Frontiers. And, you know, there are many things you can do. So one of the things is that widows in China, that we have a credible report of a widow in China who was, that the Chinese Communist Party tried to force her to renounce her faith in order to receive this little stipend, which would help her to survive, and she refused to do that. I mean, these people are heroes. Mm-hmm. But we give stipends to widows in China and certainly do not require them to renounce their faith, and in fact, we encourage them in their faith. So I think the one thing that people can do is just click to the right, it says Save a Widow, and find out more about that. A lot of widows, a lot of families of baby girls were also saving baby girls in the Chinese countryside from sex selective abortion, abandonment, and just poverty. And you can help those as well.
Reggie, always a joy to connect with you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been Reggie Littlejohn, founder and president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers, an international coalition to expose abuses against women in China. And we've been talking about recent developments about China against Catholic clergy. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Guest House invites you to the 67th Annual Detroit Bishop's Dinner, Thursday, October 9th. The evening begins with Mass at 4 p.m. at St. John Vianney Catholic Church, followed by a gourmet dinner and program at the Palazzo Grand in Shelby Township. Enjoy an inspiring keynote address from Joseph McGivney, along with an unforgettable night of faith, fellowship, and hope. For more information and to reserve your spot, visit guesthouse.org.
The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where customers come in for a great service. The 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, and a rare and collectible spirits room. We have the largest selection of spirits in the state at the most competitive prices. Ask for one of the brothers, Cliff or Kelly, and thank them for their strong support of Catholic Radio. Delivery is available. Please visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at winepalacemi.com.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. Impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood, but you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
Looking for a trusted contractor for your exterior home improvements? Call locally owned Mighty Dog Roofing today for a quote on roofing, gutters, siding, or windows. Mighty Dog Roofing uses premium products including Owens Corning Shingles and James Hardy Fiber Cement Siding, and they offer one of the best warranties in the industry through their OC Platinum Preferred status. Visit MightyDogRoofing.com today or call 833-MIGHTY-4. That's 833-MIGHTY-4.
How would you define the word beatitude? Webster's Dictionary defines beatitude as a state of utmost bliss and a declaration made in the Sermon on the Mount. The Catechism of the Catholic Church states that the Beatitudes are, in effect, a portrait of the man who declared them, Jesus Christ, depicting his countenance and portraying his charity. The Beatitudes also describe the attitudes and actions that should portray and depict his followers, true Christians. The Beatitudes are paradoxical in their promises. None seems more paradoxical than number 8, which proclaims, "Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven." The paradox is that God is present even amidst trials and tribulations. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town, where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Arthur Spita. Some time ago, I had my friend Dr. Nathan Slita on to talk about John Paul II's love and responsibility and a reassessment of it based on developing and continuing to grow our lexicon and the way we speak about sex and marriage. And Nathan joins us again. He's professor of philosophy and religion at Hillsdale College. And we're talking, this is part two of his piece at the Public Discourse, Saving Sex, Love and Responsibility Revisited. Nathan, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine, Marcus. Good to be with you on the show.
Always a joy to reconnect with you. And before we dive too deep into John Paul II, the last time you and I spoke about this, you were also sharing how you're facing this at the grassroots level with students having particular habits, attitudes, or thoughts that are detrimental. And so one of the issues that Hillsdale faces is called Hillsdating. I hear the phrase, I don't know what it means. For the sake of our listeners, if you could just explain what it is and why one ought to virtuously date instead.
That's a great question. Maybe every college campus has its version of Hillsdating, but Hillsdating here refers to a semi-exclusive relationship between a man and a woman, in which there's never any conversation about plans or dating or attraction or where this will go. It just becomes a kind of looks like a de facto dating, but there's never any actual dating. So typically in that case, you know, one of the persons is just kind of enjoying the companionship and gratification of friendship and kind of some of the perks of what would seem like dating without any cost of making any commitment. So it's a source of a lot of complaining, especially on the part of women. It seems like, where is this going here? You seem to be enjoying my friendship, in this, heightened way, but there doesn't seem to be any, other kind of interest or commitment. So it's a little frustrating. And I think, the goal is to, nudge that toward actual dating, especially casual dating. Dating is an interesting topic right now because, as you know, the script for dating has totally been lost in our culture. Many of our students, are familiar with, hookup culture on the one hand. Fortunately, there's not a lot of that here, but the other alternative seems to be a kind of more rigid form of courtship, right, in which it's sort of like pre-engagement. For some students, you call the father, mm-hmm, and ask whether you can take his daughter on a date, and there are heavy formalities to it. And I get that, but that makes the entrance ramp really steep.
Yeah,
and can be kind of counterproductive. So my wife and I are big defenders of a culture of casual dating.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that you mentioned it, because you're completely right. I think virtually every Catholic university I know of in the U.S., and Hillsdale too, you know, so every conservative university has some iteration of Hills dating. And I think it lends itself to a certain philosophy in the approach of male-female relationships as an over-corrective of what the culture is doing right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I just think these Gen Zers are just afraid of commitment. They're they want to keep options open. They are uncertain of the choices they're making. And it just seems like it's an easier way to kind of stay in this indecisive space. And so, and the guys just don't really know how to ask on dates. It's just not. This woman at Boston College did this dating video. I don't know if you saw it some years ago, the dating project. It's super interesting. She taught a class on dating, and as part of the class, the students had to go on a date.
Mm-hmm.
And she set down these criteria for the date they had to go on, which I got some of those things from my Hills dating video from her. And you have to ask in person. You have to, you know, there are all a whole series of things she put in there, the time limit, everything else. And her classes were just packed with students who didn't know how to go on a date. So you'd think that would come just very naturally, but no, there's kind of a culture that has to support that and form you in it. And so it's changed a lot since I was in college. I'm 53 or something like that. And asking people on dates was not a problem. We had problems in the 80s, don't get me wrong, but that was not one of them. Asking girls to prom, to homecoming. When we were young parents, we thought, we don't think our kids should, we didn't really want them to date. We didn't, you're not old enough to get married, don't date. And so we were worried about what was kind of a looser culture in the 80s, 70s, 80s. And so we thought, we didn't let our kids go to the homecomings and proms their freshman, sophomore years. We kind of capitulated a little bit later, but now we've done a 180 on that, because we think there's a critical time for you to learn how to ask a girl out, to show the proprieties and forms of respect and concern, open the door, close the door, how to dance, how to eat, how to do these things that are all just an important skill set that if someone doesn't teach you, you don't learn them, you're just never going to get there. So, so it's interesting what you learn as you go.
Right. And you've given me food for thought too, because I do see the merit of these social on-ramps into building those virtues necessary. And you can't build those virtues if you don't engage in the action of dating virtuously. And I guess that's a good enough segue for us to just also talk about, therefore, a culture that is generally looser about male-female relationships. And if we can pick up from the last conversation about how both Augustine but also Kant view the disorder of sexual attraction and desire, but from different perspectives.
Yes. Yes. So what they share in common is we talked about in the previous show, and I'm kind of highlighting this in the two public discourse articles. What they share in common is a very, what you might call a pessimistic view of human sexuality and sexual desire and sexual pleasure. And they've got reasons for it. I want to be fair to them. There are reasons built in our psych. This is a desire that's prone to disorder. By original sin, number one, and it's also a desire that is closely connected to the whole person. Mm-hmm. It's another point I make in the piece. You know, when you want food, you just want to eat something, you just want a burger or whatever. But when it comes to sexual desire, your whole person is implicated. And so it's truly a source of vulnerability of your whole person. And in a unique way, I think, compared to any other human inclination, our persons are at risk and they're very vulnerable. And especially in the wake of the sexual revolution, where that aspect was ignored completely or effaced, and people were lied to and told that this was just about mere pleasure, just bodily pleasure with no other consequences, so long as you, you know, took care of it through, you know, contraception or whatever. And what it left, it was very clearly now, it's the testimony, not just on the conservative side, but even some really powerful voices that are progressive leaning, like Louise Perry, have done some great work on this, just showing how the loss of modesty and sexual restraint really kind of unleashed some very ugly male sexual behavior that wounded a lot of women. Frankly, I think it wounded men too in different ways. And so I think, you know, the Kantian, Augustinian views of sexuality, we saw those kind of borne out in the sexual revolution when the kind of checks were abandoned.
Right.
And so what Dodge of the Body is doing is trying to deal with that, I think.
My guest is Dr. Nathan Schlitte. He's professor of philosophy and religion at Hillsdale College. We're talking about John Paul II, Love and Responsibility and Theology of the Body, as a kind of virtuous corrective to the bad philosophies of sex and male-female relationships in the culture. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Hello, Steve Ray here from Footprints of God Pilgrimages. Want to celebrate some amazing anniversaries this year in France? We'll visit Normandy Beach to celebrate our heroic military for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Also, the 100th anniversary of the canonization of St. Teresa of Lisieux. Join us this October for our Saints and Shrines of France and a visit to the newly renovated Notre Dame Cathedral.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
In the 14th rule, St. Ignatius of Loyola's 14 rules for the discernment of spirits, St. Ignatius teaches that the enemy looks in turn at all of our theological, cardinal, and moral virtues, and where he finds us weakest and most in need for our eternal salvation, there he attacks us and attempts to take us. Once we have identified our weakest spiritual point, we can work to strengthen it. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, "People of discernment can prepare their resistance to these deceptions before the deceptions begin. They can learn where in their spiritual lives the enemy's deceptions are most likely to occur and prepare beforehand. If they do, the enemy may be blocked before he even begins his attack. This is the final refinement of discerning awareness, understanding, and resistance to which Ignatius would lead faithful people in these 14 rules."
For more information, visit avemariaradio.net.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Underwritten in part by this not-for-profit.
Hi, this is Mike Ditka.
Hey, this is Brian May.
Hi, I'm Chris Farley. You're listening to the Kevin Matthews Show.
I thought he was insane. A lot of people thought he was insane.
Nobody could touch us. We had 10 million people listening to us a week.
That was my past. If you would have told me I'd be carrying around a broken statue of the Virgin Mary, talking about God, I'd say, are you high?
Broken Mary, the Kevin Matthews story. In theaters one day only on Tuesday, October 7th. Tickets at BrokenMaryFilm.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking to my friend Dr. Nathan Schlieter of Hillsdale College. We are talking about love and responsibility, the theology of the body, as a response to the wayward philosophies, the modern wayward philosophies of sex and marriage and male-female relationships. Nathan, I want to invite you to pick up where we left off. So you're just beginning to tell us how John Paul II's theology of the body becomes a real remedy in terms of the paradigmatic correction that's needed for culture and society.
Yeah, love and responsibility especially. Mm-hmm. It's amazing for me to see the effect this has on students. I've been taught this for 10 years. Every time I teach it, it has a kind of transformative effect. And one of those areas is the one we were just talking about. A different way of thinking about human sexuality as, at its very core, a kind of good orientation towards the great good, a unique kind of friendship, a unitive sharing and self-giving love, a two-in-one flesh union seems to be the core of that, although at an even deeper level, it is a desire for union with God. I mean, that's the great mystery inside the sexual urge that you find as far back as Plato's Symposium, and it gets reiterated to some degree in Love and Responsibility, and it kind of turns into the Genesis account that John Paul II is talking about. But we were just in class recently talking about, you know, sexual desire, and John Paul and Votia in there is talking about how women maybe especially vulnerable in some sense to being objectified and used for sexual ends, and how in some sense women need in some sense an affirmation of their whole person in order to love, and men need women to accept their self-giving, you know, love, mm-hmm. for them, and their desire to serve them and protect them. Men need that. And so you get these different needs. And every time I teach that part, I tell them what I call my, it's a funny thing. I call it my Lady Gaga apostolate. And it's very funny because I tell them almost every time I read about a woman in the press who's just sort of acting out,
right.
Either very, provocatively, sexually, whatever. This could be a movie star, porn star, whatever. I always think that person, I bet, has sexual trauma from some man in her past.
Mm.
And every time I look into it, I'm right. And it's almost without exception. And when I saw Lady Gaga wearing a meat dress in a music video years ago, I thought, and I don't know if you remember when this happened, like she wore...
It was
like
in the recesses of my memory.
Flesh, exactly, yeah. She wore a dress in the video, like with flesh, and I thought immediately, she is wounded. Like mm-hmm. She sent in a message about her feeling exploited in her body by someone, and she's acting out. And then it sort of started to come out, really came out when she did an album with this guy, Tony Bennett, who was this... Frank Sinatra-like crooner, singer, jazz singer. And they did an album together. And just I've started dwelling on this, but it's always so powerful. You can read about the interview with her in the Wall Street Journal when they made the album. But she talks about how no one had ever treated her like he had treated her in her life, that he was such a gentleman for her. And she said, when she came into the studio, she couldn't stop crying. She was so broken. She was at a low point in her life. And he had everyone in the studio stand up when she walked in. And he always wore a suit and he held the door for her. And she said, just these beautiful quotes she has about the healing effect of his just not sexualized, but just affirmation of her person had on her whole healing and development. And my students just are so responsive to that. Like they see, okay, like a real man, that's how he treats a woman.
Yeah.
A real man like loves her person, appreciates her whole person, and admires it and doesn't exploit it and protects it from others. And when a woman is treated that way, when she's treated as valuable for her own sake and not because of her, just merely her sexual attributes, she is strengthened to become more of a woman, to shine, to be the person God made her to be. And I think that's kind of what Votia places at the center of love and responsibility. That's the title, right? Love and responsibility. The point is to put love for the person at the very center of any account of sexual ethics and let that determine everything else. So it's not preoccupied with kind of setting narrow rules. And I don't want to sound, make the wrong point on that. I mean, moral rules and laws are very important. They exist for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But for Votia, they exist to protect love. That's why they exist, to enhance and protect love and the great good of human love. And if you forget that good, it just becomes a series of duties you're doing to that kind of exist in a void. And so suddenly my students, when they read that book, start seeing attractively what love can be. They start seeing what marriage could be, not just a kind of series of duties and no's to things you can't do but you really want to, but a series of no's that are in support of yeses to something greater and more beautiful.
And
so that's
something more greater and beautiful leads us to contemplate what John Paul II highlights, this language of love being necessary in the relation between male and female, but also culminating in maritally in the act of giving oneself to the other in conjugal embrace. And so all of these are necessarily integrated and unitive. They're not fragmented actions of individuals at their whim.
Right. That is really the heart of it. That was the heart of the piece that I argued, that I wrote to some degree, is to see the two one flesh union of marriage as itself. It's a union of persons. It's a unit of good. It's primarily for the good of the spouse. Children and family naturally are intimately bound up with it and are a great good that complete it. But to understand deeply and richly that unit of good, I think that's something that does not become clear in church teaching. It's the specific statement about it, I think, just doesn't even really show up until Humana Vitae in 1968. I mean, there are gestures toward it. Once you look at it, it's obvious that the two shall become one flesh, unitive. How do they become one flesh? Through the conjugal love. It's right there, but it gets lost a little bit in some of the treatments of human sexuality historically.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really in the 20th century, as all these challenges from the sexual revolution arrive, that we get a kind of, I don't want to say it's not there. I just want to say it's a very enriched and deepened understanding of the unitive good of marriage. And that argument tends to be kind of opposed strangely and maybe fittingly by two different parties. I mean, there are, of course, defenders of artificial contraception who don't value that unitive good. They don't understand it. They think that contracepted conjugal love is still unitive when it is not. When contraception turns that into an egoistic kind of transactional act per se, there's that group. That's the more obvious group. But we also, I think there are some Catholics who also think that any use of, say, natural family planning does violence to some human sexuality. That is, they think it's solely for the purpose of procreation.
Mm.
And you have to intend procreation. For them, there isn't a unity of good either. They just think contraception is wrong because the act needs to be for the purpose of procreation. That's kind of the Augustinian view. And so Motia really, I think, shows us even before, 8 years before Humana Vitae, he's paving the way for a beautiful account of human sexuality in which those unitive and procreative goods coexist in a very deep and powerful way. And so he does, I think, take something like a romantic tradition that for some people is sort of forbidden. You know, they would see romance as being part of the enemy. I think Gautier sees romantic love in some sense as a real orientation towards something good that needs to be transformed and healed and saved, but it's fundamentally the right orientation to this sort of unitive good of marriage.
And that unitive good is not just a... So, like you've been highlighting, and John Paul II talks about this, it's deeply personal, it's an interpersonal gift of bride and bridegroom, but once it's done right, the social ramifications are just outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And when we're talking about unity of care, we're not simply talking about conjugal love, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's all kinds of advice about this and comments about it, right? That act is prepared for every day, and all the small gestures of self-gift, doing the dishes, cleaning the diapers, those are all small parts of the act. But those aren't enough to make a marriage. And this has always been the constant tradition of the church that conjugal love, male-female intercourse is absolutely, it is the consummation of marriage. And consummation is such a great word. It's the same word Christ says from the cross, right? Consummatus. And the church uses the language consummation. There's a deep relationship there of perfecting that love in marriage that way.
Nathan, thank you very much for making the time. Always a joy to reconnect with you.
Great to talk with you, Marcus.
My guest has been Dr. Nathan Schlieter, Professor of Philosophy and Religion at Hillsdale College. We've been talking about John Paul II's narrative in The Theology of the Body as a corrective for the sexual ethos of our society.